Welcome to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast,
your source for everything outdoors.
Let's kick it into overdrive.
Want to lengthen your time in the field and shorten your scouting time? Not only does the HuntWise app show you property boundaries, landowners' names, and in some cases even their phone number, but using the app will show you the wind direction on the map of the place you want to hunt. And the HuntCast feature shows peak movement times for various species, including predators. Get the HuntWise app at www.huntwise.com, the Google Play Store, or the Apple App Store. For only $59.99 a year for Pro or $119.99 a year for Elite. Use promo code OVERDRIVE20 for 20% off an annual membership.
Okay, everybody, this is Kevin Rott here with our special guest tonight, Jeremy Kennedy and Mike Latrell. And let's start off by talking to Jeremy. Tell us a little bit about your hunting background and, you know, how you came to be where you're at today in terms of your hunting experiences.
Well, I met my wife in 95, and I was not a hunter, and her dad is a big hunter, and he told me I had to, in order to be in her family, I had to hunt. So that year I bought a bow, and he worked with me. And
was that before you got married? He told you that?
Yeah.
Okay. Prerequisite.
You can't have a non-hunter in his family, I guess. So first year I bought a bow and went out and shot my first doe, and then I decided I wanted to go out and try to get everything I can. And then I became a taxidermist, and now I've taken hunting farther than I thought I would. I hunt pretty much everything.
And you've hunted out of state several times. What all species have you hunted?
I've hunted elk, deer, whitetail, fallow deer, axis deer, bear in Canada, bear in the UP with you, Kevin. Birds, turkeys, out of state, been to Missouri, been to Colorado.
Now, when you say birds, you're talking upland or waterfowl? I know you've done some waterfowl.
I've only done waterfowl in Michigan. Mm-hmm. I'm not a real big waterfowl hunter, but just because I can't afford to hunt everything, I guess. I've Missouri, I've hunted turkeys and pigs. And then in Louisiana, we went down and hunted some pigs, and the three of us. Other than that, it's whatever it allows me, I will.
So you were hunting, then you got into taxidermy. Did mm-hmm. you get into taxidermy because of hunting, or?
Actually, I was selling cars, and I sold a car to a guy, and he was a taxidermist, and he always wanted to teach somebody. So we got talking, and that's how I got into taxidermy. And then it's grown since from there.
Did you get into it with the intent of having that be a business for you?
I did. And then I got up to doing about 100 deer a year plus all the other animals. And then it became a job, and then it wasn't fun anymore. So now I'm back to a hobbyist. I do about 30 deer a year plus all the other animals that I do.
And you were on the board for Michigan Taxidermist,
yep,
right?
For 7 years.
And competed?
Yep.
And yep. I know when I first came over to your shop the first time I went over there, I remember seeing you had some very unique mounts that you don't see very often. So yep. Talk about that a little bit.
When I started competing first before I was even on the board. And then, in the beginning, I competed with whitetails and your otters and any mammals, tried a few ducks. And then I worked my way up all the way up to master's taxidermy in the competition world. And I still do some competitions, but not as much as I used to. But I ended it with mountain scorpions, tarantulas, and like Madagascar cockroaches, stuff like that. I want to do something that nobody else really does. I mean, people do it, but you just don't see it.
I was going to say, I don't think I'd ever seen it prior to seeing it at your place, the work that you did. And I was just like, I was just baffled. I was trying to wrap my head around the logic of how you do it. And I know you've explained it to me, but I mean, you said you actually have to skin them.
It's a skin mount, just like it is a deer. You just take it all apart, basically skin them out. I mean, some of them are harder shell, but you still have to get everything out.
So when you skin an insect, they don't have bones per se, right? Mm-hmm. So Is it kind of like skinning an oyster? You know, you pop it open, you got
basically, but like a scorpion, you take it out, take it apart piece by piece and take everything out, and then you put it all back together.
Kind of like taking the meat out of a crab leg.
Yep. And then putting it back together. And then painting it and making right? it look real, alive.
Wow, that's pretty wild. I seen the work and it's impressive. It just, you know, my mind always thinks, how the heck do you do that? So,
I mean, a lot of people, like I said, a lot of taxidermists don't do that. And that's why I got into it. And I've actually done some for other taxidermists for displays, you know, if they have whatever it is, a snake and they want to train a scorpion with it or a bird eating spider with a starling or whatever. Then they call me and then I mount it for them just for their display.
So now obviously those aren't native to Michigan. So how do you get those animals to mount? A pet store?
I bought them from a pet store, like the Asian scorpions. I'd buy them from a pet store and I'd raise them up to the size I wanted. Same with bird eating spiders or tarantulas, you know, I'd raise them to the size I wanted and then I'd drop them in the freezer and then wow. mount them.
That's pretty wild. So you freeze them to kill them?
Yep. Yeah, freeze them 48 hours.
That's interesting. I remember I was in entomology in high school and we used, I don't remember if it was like chloroform or something like that. We'd put the insect in a jar and put, I think it was chloroform or something on a cotton swab, throw it in there and it would kill them.
And you can do that, but you can get the chloroform can yellow the like on a spider, it could yellow the hairs that are on its legs.
Oh, okay.
Or they can make them fall out if it touches the chloroform.
Okay.
Because a spider is, if you touch it wrong or hard, all them pairs come off.
You break it off.
Yeah.
I know that's one thing we had to be careful of in entomology with like moths, because if you touch them, I mean, basically they have real fine feathers on their wings. And if you touch them, you'll rub that right off and you ruin the look of the
same thing with spider. Okay. The hairs will fall right off and the legs will be totally bald.
So like when you do a mammal, after you skin it, you have to tan the hide and whatever. Yep. Do you still have to do that with an insect?
Yeah, the tanning process is quite a bit different. I tan all my insects and spiders. No, spiders I don't. My scorpions and like Madagascar cockroaches, I tan them all in acetone.
Really?
And it makes this in
dries them out.
Well, no. You soak them right in it. I mean, it's a full bottle of acetone, and then they're not acetone, alcohol. Excuse me.
Okay.
And denatured alcohol. And it makes their skin, like on the bellies of a scorpion or a Madagascar cockroach, their skin on the bottom. And it makes that skin a little tougher so you can work with it.
Hmm. That's interesting. So what's the biggest animal you've mounted?
I've done life-size bears. I've helped with bigger animals. Grizzly I've helped with other taxidermists. But otherwise I do a lot more shoulder mounts, but I do life-size bears too.
Oh, wow. That's one thing that would be really cool if you had the room to put it up someplace. I mean, I've seen some really impressive mounts through the catalogs at your place and, you know, just looking online and some of that, like you see somebody has a polar bear mount. I mean, right. Those things are huge.
They are.
There ain't no way I could have room for something like that in my house. And I probably couldn't afford one anyway.
I see like a full-size elephant. Just the form on it. I mean, it's like $26,000 just for the foam form.
So then have you ever done, I know like since I think they banned the importation of African game animals back into the country, right?
No.
Okay. But there's a lot of guys though that will do recreations as opposed to
like a hippo. There's certain animals you can't bring back or you can't even kill.
Okay.
Like a rhino. And then they'll do a replica, basically.
So when they do that replica, are they using a form similar to taxidermy and then just paint it?
Nope. A replica, basically, the same thing as like a replica fish. When you order a replica fish, it comes with the scales and everything right on it.
Okay.
So then you comes ready to paint, basically. Okay. I mean, you got some prep work, but it comes ready to paint and you paint it. And same thing with, you can order like a rhino.
Okay.
So, and then hippos are the same way.
I always kind of wondered how that worked because I know for a while there, some people, certain species, they weren't allowed to harvest or whatever. So they would, I don't know the whole process, but they'd end up getting reproductions of the animal, whatever. I didn't know how that worked. That's kind of interesting.
Well, you can still ship almost every animal besides like rhinos and stuff like that that are protected.
Right.
You can still ship them back from Africa.
And you can't import ivory, correct?
Correct.
So
it's all artificial ivory.
Artificial. So, like, if you got an elephant, the tusks have to be artificial.
Same thing with, like, polar bear. You can't shit polar bears anymore either.
Really?
Nope. Last I knew, that could have changed, but last I knew.
You know why that is?
I don't. Well, from what I've read, is there's not as many as what there was in the past, so they don't even really hunt them anymore.
Okay. Huh. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
In the back in the day when you could hunt them, I know a gentleman that shot a polar bear. It took 13 years to get the hide back into the States from where Canada or wherever
Holy
he shot
cow.
It.
That many years.
Yep.
And the hide was still good.
Well, they freeze it.
Okay.
And I don't know if he had it tanned there and then froze it. I don't know how they went about that, but it couldn't leave. I think it was up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't leave Canada without a special permit. And it took 13 years. And then, just like African, they got to go through customs. So mm-hmm. it takes a long time. Right. So a lot of people, when they go hunt Africa, they have them tanned there or even mounted there and then shipped back after they're mounted.
Which I imagine the shipping costs on something like that would just be crazy too.
Because most of them life size them too.
So. But if you're hunting an animal like that, it's you most of the time are going to know that going in. I mean,
right.
Hunting an exotic animal is not a inexpensive undertaking. Plains game in Africa, you can get into plains game in Africa cheaper than you can go hunt an elk out west.
Yep.
But again, it's a fair amount of expense. So you'd have to think going into it that, hey, if I'm going to get a mount of this, it's going to be pretty pricey.
Right. Talking about that, or I just actually met a property owner this week. I walk in their house and it is nothing but Africa safari animals everywhere, like mounts everywhere on their walls. So we got discussing, you know, what is the price of this? And out there with their outfitter, they got 10 tags of 10 different animals mm-hmm. on one tag. It was like a combo tag.
Probably
10
Plains games.
Yeah. Yep. And it was cheaper to do that and airfare than it was to go out west and hunt elk.
Yep, with a good guide.
But a lot of safaris, they do like what they call a la carte, where they'll sell you 10, you know, you're going to pick this package that's going to come with 10 Plains games. But then for an extra $5,000, you can shoot a leopard, or an extra $3,000, or whatever the price is, you can shoot a zebra or a giraffe, or you can add to your hunt.
Yeah. And see, now I think Alan Piller, who lives over here by me, he had that with his mother, which his mom impresses me, because at 80 years old, she completed the big five in Africa at 80. She broke her hip on one of the hunts over there. But I don't know if it was last year, year before, whatever, but not long ago, he went on a hunt over there and the guide called him and says, hey, I have two management giraffes that we need to take out. He says, are you interested? And he's like, yeah. So they ended up going over there and getting giraffe. And they, you know, a lot of people, the anti people get pissy. Well, they're in danger, blah, blah, blah. Why'd you shoot that? Blah, blah, blah. Well, again, it was a management animal, which means the animal was either old and sickly, wasn't in good health, or it was becoming a danger somehow to a community around there. A lot of people don't realize that, but elephants, hippos are extremely dangerous, but elephants, giraffes, hyenas, all those animals can actually pose quite a danger to the locals over there. And when they have a problem animal, the guides will get permission basically to take that animal, and then they'll sell that hunt to a hunter. And in turn, that money goes back into, you know, helping preserve terrain for the animals, whatever. The locals oftentimes eat the animal.
Oh, yeah. Most of all the meat's donated to the local tribes or whatever, and they take care of, there ain't a stitch of meat left on the bones.
Matt Hughes, who used to be a prize UFC fighter, did a video. He had a show called Matt Hughes Uncaged. It was a hunting show. He was a big time hunter, and he did a show, whole episode one time about shooting a hippo over there. And he says it is just absolutely crazy how fast, once you take that animal, there's not like a lot of cell phones over there, see, but it's crazy how fast people show up, mm-hmm. help get that animal out and process it. He says, I mean, like whole villages will come process that animal. There ain't nothing left when they're done. They're taking it home to eat it, using everything. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand about that. That's really interesting to me. So how many mounts do you have of your own, you think?
We started a podcast the other day, and I went home, actually counted them. I actually have 46 at my house right now.
Really?
That are your own?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many do you have, Mike?
I have six. six mounts, including two European mounts.
Okay. Well, you guys both got me beat because right now I have three. I got two more on the way from you, yep. A gray fox and a bear. Yep. And I've got two coyotes and bobcat and then European mounts. But I know that's, to me, it's just another way to, you know, kind of honor the animal, remember the hunt and everything else. And especially to me, something unique, like the bobcat I got done was the first bobcat I've ever gotten. The coyote I got there was probably one of the bigger, prettier coyotes I've ever gotten. The coyote that you did for me, the pedestal mount I got in the house, was first coyote I ever got mounted. I mean, I've tanned hides before, but that was the first mount I've ever got, period. So, I mean, there's something to be said about, you know, getting an animal mounted when you can and having that memory, being able to show it to other people, tell the story about it, everything. One question I've talked to you about before, and maybe this might help some other people. Let's say you have a good mount, whatever it is, it's a mammal.
Yep.
What's the best way to keep that mount looking good in your house?
If you stay on it, you can just use like a feather duster. Okay. But if it gets too soiled with lint or dust or anything, you want to take all you need is a wet washcloth and go with the fur.
Okay.
If it's really bad, you can actually, depending on if you know your taxidermist and you know how it's mounted, you can actually give them a bath. But I would recommend bringing that back to your taxidermist to talk to them about that. But a wet washcloth does wonders, and just go with the fur. And if you get it, you can actually get it pretty wet, but then just blow dry it.
Okay. And one thing you told
just
me,
just stay away from like the anything painted, okay. Eyes, nose, that type of stuff that has paint, because you don't know if you use water base or lacquer base.
So keep it on.
Just the fur.
On fur.
Right. And you can, like I said, the feather duster does wonders. And then if you want to, if the eyes are dirty, they get gritty with the dust, you can actually just take Windex, spray it on a Q-tip. Cleaner. Yep. And then just clean that off and then use a dry Q-tip to go back around it. Just be careful of the painted areas.
So I remember one thing you told me for sure you don't want to do is don't touch it with your hands.
The oil from your hands is what oil that gets on the fur collects dust.
Okay.
And if you keep, everybody wants to touch them.
Right.
But if you keep doing that, the oil from your hands will actually get on that fur and then collect more dust over the years. And then gotcha. It makes it harder and harder to clean. The other bad thing to have is your mount's in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Or I fixed a mount for a guy that had it above a hot tub. Well,
that sounds like a bad idea to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even really the moisture. It's the chlorine that's in the air and it bleached it. It was a whitetail. It bleached it right out. It looked like almost a white whitetail.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was a yellow white whitetail, right. But it was really bleached.
So with our deer season coming up, we got bear season. What would be, if someone is potentially thinking about getting one of those animals mounted that they got, before they start anything on the animal, what's the best piece of advice you could give them if they want to take it to a taxidermist?
If you don't know how to cape, don't cape. That's the big thing. Don't slit a deer's neck. Don't, when you gut it, don't gut it up too high into the brisket. These are all common mistakes. And if you know how to cape it down all the way to the neck, skin it out all the way to the neck, you only need to leave about 4 inches of neck meat on that. Well, some people like to bring it all the way up to the skull. Well, that's where we take our measurements, is the neck meat. And I take my measurements from the neck meat, and then when it comes back from the tannery, I measure it again. The biggest, it's funny they asked that, because I just finished the hunter safety course online with my son. And the one thing that they talk about is what you need when you shoot a deer and you want to preserve it and take it to a taxidermist. They tell you to bring salt to put on the hide. Do not salt your own hide, because what's salt do? It dries. It dries out the meat.
Oh.
Well, I have to get that meat off. And if it's dried right to it, you can't get it off. And a lot of people, what they do is they'll salt the hide. Not a lot, but some people, they salt the hide, throw it in the freezer. What do we use to take ice off our sidewalks? Salt. That meat is not going to freeze. All it's going to do is rot.
Didn't think about that.
Salt will not let it freeze.
Okay.
So if you salt your hide with a bunch of meat on it, you put it in the freezer. It's all it's going to do is rot. It's going to slow it. The freezer will slow it down.
Right.
But if you leave it in there for a long enough time, it's going to rot.
That's good information.
And it just makes your job 10 times harder.
Because it's beef jerky at that point. Well, right. Trying to get beef jerky off of deer hide, you can't do it.
Right.
And then you'll get freezer burn where the salt's not around where the salt, because the salt's not letting the meat freeze, but the hide's freezing, get a bunch of freezer burn. Other thing is if you don't have time to get your deer to the taxidermist right away and you're going to put it in a freezer, put the whole thing in a garbage bag, ears and all. And if you can, get the antlers in there. If not, tape or zip tie around the antlers so no air can get in that bag. So that's the main tips, because you can leave that deer in the freezer for a year, mm-hmm. as long as you have it wrapped right. Okay. Otherwise, you're just making the taxidermist's life harder, or you're going to lose your cape, get hair slippage, stuff like that. If you're going to do a year amount on it, put it in the freezer. Cut the head off, put it in the freezer. Don't put it in a bag and set it in the corner. And I've had people do it every year. Well, when I pick that out of that bucket or that bag, everything slides right off, and you can imagine what that smells like. Right. It's horrid. Like, it's so bad. And then you're going to get charged. Most time you'll get charged a spoilage fee. So it can be anywhere from $25, I've seen all the way up to $300 for a spoilage fee, because nobody wants to mess with that.
Right. And I would assume, obviously, your chances of getting a good mount are a lot less, or it's going to equal more work for your taxidermist, right. Hence why they charge
you. Well, and if you're doing a year amount and it's rotten like that, it's going to stain the skull. And then you're making more work for the beetles or whatever in the bleaching process or whatever. You're making more work for your taxidermist.
Okay.
You know, and if you have questions, call your taxidermist.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a taxidermist, call a local taxidermist.
Call
me. I don't care. I'll answer anybody's questions, whether you live here or you live in Colorado. I don't care. I'll answer your questions. But you want to make sure you take care of your animal. You spend all this money to shoot the buck of a lifetime, and then you mess it up during transport or freezing it or whatever, or you cheap out and try to find the cheapest taxidermist out there. That's not the way to do it. You know, an average person spends up to $10,000 on killing the trophy that they want, and then they want the guy that's $325 for a shoulder mount. It makes no sense. Right. But you spent $1,800 on a bow,
right?
So you're cheaping out on the part you see,
right? And that's gonna last the longest,
right.
Probably,
right?
Taken care of.
That exactly.
Now, myself, I, because of the cost of taxidermy and all that, I try and save it for something special. Like right now, to be honest with you, I'm saving money for a full body mount of a black coyote if I ever get fortunate enough to get one. Or if I ever get the chance of wolf, I would pay for a full body mount of that.
Well, I let you make payments.
It's right.
It's called me building guns.
Right.
You know, and that's how we've always done.
Right.
So,
but the point is, I'm not just going to mount any old animal anytime soon. So what would be your next animal that you'd want to mount?
Well, we were just talking about this. If it was a bear, it'd have to be a really big bear. Because I have a couple bears that are mounted. Well, I have one now, and I got another one that I'm showing. I shot with you that I'm mounting, and they're both smaller bears. Mm-hmm. For me to do a full body, it'd have to be a pretty big bear, 450, 500 pounds, somewhere in there. Again, if I shot a black coyote, I'll full body mount. I've been doing the dead mounts for mm-hmm. my coyotes.
Yeah, that was really nice.
I'd like to get a gray fox as a dead mount. I'd like to do a red fox as a dead mount. I also like to do a bobcat as a dead mount.
That would be cool.
And I'd have them all on one piece of wood, yep. So it looks, you know, like they're hanging there, all of them.
That'd be cool.
Like that mount too.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then of course your dream animals. I definitely would full body mount a mountain lion, and that's one of my dream animals. And so is a wolf. Mm-hmm. And I'm never gonna, if I shoot a wolf, it's automatically get a full body mount. I don't care if it's a pup, it's getting a full body mount. But
yeah. What about you, Mike?
I'll always mount a decent mature whitetail. I'd say anything that's 8 points or scores over 100 inches in Michigan, I'm more than likely putting it on the wall.
Do you have a bucket list animal though?
I was going to say mountain lion like you. That is probably one of my biggest bucket lists. I don't want to run it with dogs. I want to call it in. Nothing wrong with running with dogs.
Just not my cup of tea.
Just not my cup of tea one bit. And I don't know if that's just because hunting with you guys and the predator aspect of calling that predator in. But a mountain lion would be my – and then a wolf. I mean, a wolf.
I think that's all three of our
– That's going to be – yeah. I mean, a wolf would be – right up there. I'd do a full body mount on a wolf.
Hey, you know, they're having another season in Wisconsin this fall.
That's true.
I bought a point.
We have a preference point already.
We do have one preference point.
I do have a spot we can go. I've made a couple of contacts over there.
I'm getting many times.
I love whitetails though on my wall. My wife's not growing too fond of less room for decor.
Right. Take the pictures of the kids off, put a deer off.
That's how it's turning out right now.
Well, how do you think I feel? My wife's a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's true.
She don't like any animals in her house, but they're there.
Yeah. But no, I would do at least a shoulder mount of a mountain lion.
Mm-hmm. I'd full body up.
I don't know if I had the room.
I'd make the room.
Yeah, I could always put it on my ceiling or something.
Just get a bigger house.
Yeah, I could always get a
bigger house. Build a trophy room.
I could do that.
You know, when it's your bucket list animal, it deserves, in my mind, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying it as a taxidermist, but as my mind, it deserves what I want to see. I want to be able to see the whole thing. And yeah, they're cool. The shoulder mounts are cool, but something about that big fluffy tail and it's just, they're beautiful animals. And same with the wolf. I mean, they're so big.
Mm-hmm. You know, very big.
And I've talked, me and my son went out hunting and I shot a nice 10 point and I didn't end up finding it until the cape was spoiled. But when I shot it, I told him I'm full body mounting this deer. You know, we found it late. Actually, the coyotes got it. So I never did mount it. But it'd have to be a big whitetail. And if my son was with me and it was a big whitetail, I'd probably pull a body mount. But I'm in a little different situation than you guys because I do my own mount. So, but they're still expensive.
And plus, you have a nice big room to put all of
them. Yeah. I got a pretty nice place.
Yeah.
I know, but a buddy of mine, he actually was my boss at one of the places I worked. He went down to Texas and shot an eland, mm-hmm. which, for anyone doesn't know, it's the largest member of the antelope family in the world.
And they're huge.
And they're native to Africa, but he shot it down in Texas at a ranch.
You can shoot anything in Texas.
Yep. And that animal, if I remember right, he said went 1,200 pounds. And he got a shoulder mount done of it. And he put it in his basement, which I was over there once. And I think he had standard like 8-foot ceilings in his basement. Mm-hmm. The brisket on that eland was on the floor. And the horns were within an inch of the ceiling.
Same thing with an elk. If you only got 8-foot ceilings and you shoot a decent mature bull, that's what happens. The brisket's on the ground and the tips of the antlers are touching the ceiling.
Right. Have to take out a ceiling panel and fit up in there.
A skylight.
Drill holes in your drywall. Right. Stick the points in there.
Yeah. But, so to segue from there, we're getting ready to go bear hunting here in Michigan end of this month. And that's something you said you'd like to do something with if you're successful in getting a bear, though, right, Mike?
Yeah, actually, we were just talking about before we started this podcast that I would do at least a shoulder mount, you know, more than likely of a nice bear. I'm not going to be probably as picky as you guys on my bear selection shots, but a decent, you know, a bear up there, I'm at least looking into a shoulder mount. Actually, I already talked to my wife on where I'd put it.
Oh, so. Yeah. Right above the bed?
No, she will not let me bathroom? Do that. That's pretty much where she tells me to put everything.
Don't put it in the bathroom. Yeah. Steam is bad.
Yeah. No, but I'm at least doing, you know, getting the tan, the hide tanned.
So this will be your first time ever bear hunting.
Very first time.
And
I've never even seen a bear.
Yep. Never seen a bear in the wild. You've seen them up at... Oswald. The bear Oswald's
up in the UP.
So being that you've seen all those ones at Oswald's.
You won't see one that big, I guarantee.
I was just going to say, does that give you a comparison for you're going to be out there in the stand and all of a sudden there's a bear? Well, that one's bigger than the one at Oswald's. Or, no, that one's smaller than the one at Oswald's.
Maybe the cub that I took a picture with.
So we will be baiting. We're not running dogs.
Correct.
This will be Jeremy and I's second time up hunting with Randy Booty and his brother Joe, so we have a little bit more experience with it. And that being said, you have a lot more experience, Jeremy, hunting bear than either one of us do. How many times have you been to Canada for bear?
Four times.
All springtime?
No, all fall.
All fall.
Always in August. I always went over my anniversary.
Okay. Yeah, that's always
good. My wife loves bear hunting.
Yep. Were you successful each time?
Nope. Two times I went. The first time I went, we get up there, and of course we get up there, and it's my buddy owns outfitter, and he says we're getting ready to go out for that night, and he says, all right, don't shoot the first bear you see. Well, in Canada, you hunt with 55-gallon drums. They put the bait in 55-gallon drums. And so I get up in my tree, and he drops you off, and the first night, the rest of the nights, you'd go by yourself. But he drops you off, points in the right direction, tells you how to get there. It's three quarters of a mile back in the woods. When I get almost to my stand, he says, there's a barrel strapped to this tree. Okay. So he says, turn right at that barrel. All right. So I see the barrel, and it's crazy because the ground's all hollowed out under, you can see the roots of the tree, the bark's gone 6 feet up. I didn't think nothing of it. Try and find my tree and walk in, and it was called the wagon wheel. And this barrel is in the middle of this little, and it's only like 15-yard field all the way around, it's about as far as you can see. And this barrel's in the middle, and I'm like, man, that's weird. You get up in the tree, and now I know why it's called a wagon wheel, because there's so many trails coming into this. So sitting there, about 15, 20 minutes goes by, and I'm looking around. I look to the right, no bear. Look to the left, no bear. Look back to the right, no bear. Look back at the barrel, and the bear's already on the barrel. And this bear was big. And he's walked around the barrel a couple times and sniffed it, and then he left. Didn't even tip the barrel over, but he was there. Probably, it felt like 20 minutes, but it was probably only about two. He left. Another bear came in, and this bear, and bear was a lot smaller. I should have shot the first bear, is what I'm thinking. But I kept hearing my buddy, don't shoot the first bear you see. Well, that little bear left. Third bear came in, and he was a decent bear. I probably should have shot him too, but I didn't, because I've seen that first bear. I go back to camp that night, and he says, so what'd you see? I said, I've seen three bears. He goes, what was the first bear? I said, I'll get to that. He looked at me kind of funny, and I said, all right, well, the third bear was up to the second ring on the barrel. Well, that's a good bear, he says. That's probably a 350-pound bear. And he goes, what about the first bear? So I'll get to that. So I said, the second bear I seen was about first ring on the barrel. It wasn't very big at all. He said, yeah, that's probably a 125-pound bear. And I said, well, the first bear I seen, he was about 4 inches over the whole barrel.
Wow.
And he says, and you didn't shoot it? I said, no, because you're the one that told me not to shoot the first bear I see. I've never been bear hunting a day in my life. Never, right. And I was in my shoes, never seen a bear in the woods other than like Oswald's or a zoo or something like that. Right. And he says, yeah, you should have shot that bear. That bear was all 550. So I hunted that whole week for that bear, and I never seen it again. So I went home empty-handed, paid him, went home empty-handed. Next year, we went up there again. The berries were really bad that year. Blueberries, chokeberries, everything was bad that year. And I only seen one bear.
You mean bad as in there was a lot of them?
Okay.
So they had natural food.
Right. And they weren't hitting the baits like they did the year prior. And I seen one bear, and it was first ring bear. So I hunted all week, went home empty handed. And then in the next 2 years, I shot bears. But they were all, none of them were huge. Third year I went, my wife told me I can't come home without a bear, because we've already spent, you know, $5,000 or so. So third year I went up, and that first bear I seen I shot, and I would have swore it was a 350-pound bear. And it was up to the second ring. Well, after I shot it, I got down and I realized the barrel's in a little gully. So it wasn't a big bear.
Right.
And he was 140 pounds, I think he was. She was. And I got him, and then next year was not much bigger.
That's one thing we've talked about a lot is bears, at least from what I've seen and read, are one of the hardest animals to field judge, because you're looking at size.
Yep. And there's no antlers
right
to go by.
And they also have a lot of ground shrinkage, which I experienced with, I've taken two bears so far, and I experienced that with both of them. The first one I shot, bear came in, and it was the first day of my season. It was warm that year. It was like 90 degrees. I'd been in my spot for maybe an hour, and I look up, there's a bear at the bait. And of course the bear looks at me, and I'm only like 35 yards away. Bear looks at me, walks around the bait, and then starts circling me. And it's so thick in there, just probably like same as Canada. Once it gets in that brush, you can't see them.
You can't hear them.
And that's the other thing. Bears, you don't hear them unless you shot at them and they're running. And even then
you really don't hear them unless you get the moan.
So I knew this bear was circling me, and I'm sitting there with a single shot rifle. I had a sidearm with me too, but a single shot rifle. And I'm thinking, this is so thick. If that bear's coming to me, it's going to be like in my lap before I can see it, you know? So I'm just nervous as heck. Well, after a while, the bear came back to the bait. He
walked around the bait again, opened it up, started chowing down. I looked at it, it's like, man, that looks like a good bear. Pulled up my gun, took a shot, bear took off running. Didn't hear a death moan, didn't hear it crash, didn't hear anything. And I was assuming I hit. I mean, 35 yards, I was nervous as heck, of course, but I figured I should have hit it. Well, of course, when the bear ran, he ran the same direction I had to go to get back to the side-by-side to get back to camp. You guys know me well enough to know I'm not a real good navigator in the woods. I can get turned around super easy. But I tell you what, I circumvented that path to get back to the side-by-side and still found the side-by-side amazingly. Drive back to camp and got a hold of Joe and I told him, hey, I shot at a bear. I'm pretty sure I hit it. He says, well, did it drop there? I said, no, it ran. He said, okay. So we got back in the side-by-side, drove out there. He says, let's go back to the bait, look for blood and everything first, see if you hit it. You know, we got back, we were only 10, 15 yards away from the bait. And he says, there's your bear right there. And he points over in the woods and I look, I seen the black fur. So I go over there and I walk up to it and I'm like, that's a lot smaller than it looked when it was standing at the bait. I said, sure, this is my bear. He said, well, I don't think there's going to be another one around here, you know? So, and then the second one, which was up with you, same thing. I remember when that bear came out that I shot, which mine was the last bear taken of that season for us up there. I remember
last day. Few hours.
I remember that bear came out. I was actually playing around on my phone, I think, or something. And Jeremy's like, bear. And I'm like, what? He's bear.
No, he didn't go what? He goes, what? Right?
And I look up and there's this bear. And I think one of the first things I said to Jeremy, I said, is that the big one we've been getting on camera? And I think Jeremy said, no, but it looks all right.
And you got to remember, we're down to the last couple hours.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, or you're going home empty handed.
Right. Yeah. Because we'd hunted that whole, week, 10 days. And you got your bear third day. And then we had, like I said, we're down to the last day or so of my hunt. And everything we'd been getting was on camera was nocturnal.
Yep.
We got done eating lunch that day and they were asking me when you're going to go out. I said, I figure I'll go out, you know, last hour or so before dark. There's no sense going out earlier because they're all nocturnal. And Jeremy says, ah, let's go out. We're not doing anything anyway. So we went out, sat down. And it wasn't very long.
No.
Probably within an hour.
Yeah. Within an hour. Yeah. We did use the pop-up blind on yours and we got that all set up and I didn't get the camera turned on. We started playing around on our phones. And
right.
Kevin don't look up apparently. And so I can check all the time and I was looked down, looked up and there the bear was.
Yeah.
That was a cool hunt, you know, cause we shared both of our hunts together. Cause I had second season, you had third. And we hunted together, which was a lot of fun because, you know, you could talk and, hey, look at this, you know, type thing. And so we shared a lot and you were there when I shot my bear.
Yep.
That's a whole nother story because we used my turkey blind, basically it's a little screen. And the day before we were looking at trail cams and I seen this bear on trail cams and he had a blaze. And I said, that's the bear I want. I don't care what size it is. I want to shoot one with the blaze. So we went out that day and the next day and got in this spot. And
for anyone that doesn't know, a blaze is, this one has a white V on its chest.
Yes.
So a blaze is a white marking usually on the chest of a bear.
Yes. So we get set up and get the turkey blind all set up, the little screen. And we're sitting there and Kevin gets tired of sitting in a chair. I think you were sitting in a chair. So he sits on the ground, the camera's set up and he's laying on the ground. And I think he's probably playing on his phone like normal. And I'm so focused. I just keep watching. Waiting for movement, and finally I see movement behind the bait, and the bear circles, comes in. I said, Kevin, bear. He just sat there. Kevin, bear. Oh, he reaches up, and he had the camera, and I didn't have my ATN at that. I had an ATN, but not on that gun. And he reaches up and hits record. And I said, are you ready? He goes, yep. I said, all right. So I put that bead on his shoulder, and I shot, and bear takes off. And Kevin gets up and we get our thermals out. We're trying to look in these thick woods for bear. And I look it over and I said, Kevin, there's a bear. And he goes, well, shoot it. I go, no, all I got is a headshot. Because we assumed it was my bear. And so I'm watching this bear through the thermal and I'm looking through the scope and I could see him plain as day, the head. And he's like, shoot in the head. I said, no, I want to mount it. It's got that blaze on it. And he's like, all right, we'll wait for it to drop. Well, it disappeared. So I walk over there, and where that bear was standing, there's nothing. No blood, no bear.
Like, where the heck did it go?
So I go, well, let's walk up to the bait and find the blood trail, follow it back and see where it went. And again, no death moan, no nothing. So I get almost all the way to the bait, and my bear's like just out of the range of, in that field, just out of the range in the woods. And I'm like,
it's like what, 15 yards?
Yeah. Yeah, it only went 15 yards. And I look at Kevin, I go, well, I'm glad I didn't listen to you because I'd have shot another bear.
Yep.
And honestly, I think looking back after that, I believe it was the bigger bear that we were getting on camera. Yeah. We were getting a few bears on that at that spot.
Yeah.
But that bear looked, you know, thinking about it, it looked bigger than the bear I shot. And if I'd have waited 10 more minutes, I could have shot probably a bigger bear, quite a bit bigger bear, but I got my blaze and it's getting mounted.
Yeah.
It's funny how bears are, that you can't hear them come in and you can't hear them leave. Whether you pass on them or shoot them, you don't hear them.
Mm-hmm.
They're a comical animal to watch, especially if using bait and stuff, because they'll come in, smell around, they'll walk away like they didn't see or smell anything.
I think the funniest time I had watching bears was when I was hunting up in the Barriga unit, and I had a sow come in with three cubs. And the sow came in, she just started circling the bait. Well, the cubs ran right to the bait. Well, the way this guy had his bait is he has a hole in the ground. It's pretty solid. And then he puts a big log on top of it and then puts the biggest rock he can find on top of that. That way no other animals get into the bait. So these cubs come up there, and two of the cubs come right up and they start trying to open that bait. And they're pushing on, and they're making a bunch of noise, kind of, you know, talking back and forth, trying to get this bait open while the sow walks around. Well, a buddy of mine had given me a bunch of honey from his beehives that he wasn't going to let someone eat. So we had taken and poured that honey over a rock off to the side. So two of these cubs are over there just trying to get that bait open and making a bunch of noise. The third cub went over and found that honey. And he's over there just, nom, 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 just licking that honey like you wouldn't believe. So eventually the sow gets tired of listening to the cub. She goes over, there's one paw just whacks, opens up the bait, and they tear into it. And you know, they were just sitting there mowing away on the bait, and that other one's over there chowing down on the honey. And all of a sudden, the cubs just took off running. And I'm like, you know, I think I was 50 yards from the bait. Wind was in my favor. So I'm like, I don't know why they took off running. Well, then the sow followed them, of course. And a little bit of backstory, being that this was my second time bear hunting, and I asked the guy that I was hunting with, I said, when should I be concerned if I see a bear that this bear's knows I'm here and is ticked off? He says, they'll start popping their jaws. Mm-hmm. That's when you should be worried. So the sows took off. I heard them go up a tree. I mean, you could hear them scrambling up the tree. They were out of sight. I couldn't see them. But then all of a sudden I started hearing this noise. It was like a popping noise. And I'm like, crap, here we go. Never did see them again. They disappeared. But it was so cool watching those cubs try and open that bait, and the one going to town on the honey and all that. Like you said, I mean, they're a fun animal to watch.
Well, one year in Canada, I'm up in a tree stand, and it was a homemade tree stand that the outfitter made, and it was sturdy. I'm sitting up in the tree, and all of a sudden, this bear comes in. It's a smaller bear, and all of a sudden, he walks up to the base of my tree, starts climbing my steps. I don't know if I've ever been that scared. And I drew my bow, pointing it straight down. I said, you take a couple more steps. And I'm talking to it like we're talking here. And I'm like, you taking a couple more steps, I'm going to have to shoot you. And it finally got down and walked away.
But just wandered away.
Could have took another step, but I'd had to shoot that bear.
You know, I haven't been around a lot of bears. The first year I went up hunting, I seen one bear. Second to the last day I was there, he came in, opened up the bait, got some stuff on his paws, walked off, sat down and ate it, and then he left. That's the only bear I seen the first time I was up there. The second time I was up there, I ended up seeing five or six bears. And one juvenile bear came right up below me. I was in a tree stand that night, right below me. Looked up at me and just wandered away. Pretty casual, really.
Mm.
And then the sow and the three cubs. And then the first year up there hunting with Randy, first day of season, I shot my bear. That was the only bear I seen. He circled me, but again, he wasn't in any hurry. He didn't seem aggressive, anything like that. And then last year, I was with you and we got yours. Yours was casual. The other one we seen looked pretty casual. Mm-hmm. The one I shot was casual. It's funny because bears really, I haven't seen one get excited yet other than when you shoot them.
Right.
I haven't seen one get aggressive or anything. About the scariest position I was in bear hunting was I was in a stand up in Barriga in the tree stand, and just at dark, something started breaking a bunch of brush behind me, and it sounded like something big. And I, you know, I kept looking behind me, but I couldn't see anything because it's so thick. And it got dark, and I'm like, you know, it quieted down for a second. I'm like, I'm gonna get out of here, go to the two track, because Scott's gonna be coming to pick me up here. So I get down. As soon as I get down, it starts breaking brush again. It's not leaving breaking brush. It's just breaking brush behind me. So I was only 35 yards or so from the two track. I get out to the two track, get out there. All of a sudden, I hear wolves howling in front of me. I figured within probably a couple hundred yards. So I got wolves howling in front of me. I got something breaking brush behind me. I got a single shot rifle. I got on the CB and I called Scott and I'm like, hey, are you coming to pick me up or what? And he's like, 10-4, I'm on my way. I'm sitting there. I had my headlamp. I'm scanning everywhere. I got my pistol out and I'm looking for eyes, anything I could see. Never did see anything. Pretty soon Scott comes around, picks me up, and I told him what happened. Well, the way Scott did it is he didn't use cameras. What he would do is he'd put his bait out and then he'd rake the whole area around the bait and then just come back the next day and look at the tracks. And he'd be able to tell from the size of the tracks what he had, etc. And when we went back the next day and looked, there was some big tracks on that bait. So we figured that's what it was. That bear was behind me, knew I was there, but you know, he's gonna make some noise and let us know that he was there. But we never did see another bear after that. Mm-hmm. And that, so two times up there in Barriga, I never got a shot at a bear. And then first time hunting with Randy, I got my first bear, and then my second bear after that.
Yeah, the first year I went up to Canada, I was hunting that mate, that big bear I seen the first day. I ended up seeing 16 bears that year.
Holy cow. Wow.
And some of them could have been the same bears. I'm not right. saying 16 sightings of bears on that bait.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home empty handed.
That's crazy.
And it's, you know, it was only because I like it, same thing with whitetails. I like to kill big whitetails. I like to kill big everything. If I knew that big bear was there,
right?
That's what I wanted. And if I wouldn't have seen that big bear, if I'd have seen three, because I seen plenty of 300 pounders that week I was mm-hmm. there, I would have shot one of them, but I knew that big bear was there,
right?
You know, and he was big.
So here's a question for both of you, because you both been up to these bait sites before. And this will be my first year. So in Michigan, we cannot use barrels.
No, correct. Well, you can on private land now.
Can you?
Yes. And I but know that. You can only have like a hole in it, like 2 inches.
Yeah. See, the hole, you can't have the lid come off.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So in our bait sites, we do not have barrels at our bait sites.
Right.
So these bait sites are established bait sites that have been
30 years.
How many years?
30 years.
30 years he's used these
bait. Over 30.
Over 30 years yep. he's used these same bait sites. So would you be allowed, and I'm just thinking this, it just popped in my head right now, and I'm wondering if someone else is thinking this. Would you be allowed to put, let's just say, like a wooden dowel somehow established by your bait site to determine the size of bears?
Yep.
Oh yeah, you can.
And that's something we talked about before, is putting some sort of marker there that you could use to judge the size of the bear.
All you'd have to do is take, you know, get one of them wintertime orange stakes that they use for plowing,
mm-hmm.
and wrap a piece of tape, go up to a 55-gallon drum, figure you're going to stick it in the ground 6 inches. Stick it in that ground 6 inches, and then wrap a piece of tape around each.
Represent each ring.
Yeah, and then the top of the barrel, wrap around another for the top, and then that would be an easy way to do it.
Because this is going to be my first year up there, so I mean, judging a bear is going to be
and the other tough thing, the other thing,
and I'm going to tell you, the first year going up there,
all bears are going to be huge.
They're all
huge. We were looking at some already on camera, and yeah, I would have misjudged them bears already.
And I'm going to tell you right now, being the first year up there, even if you did that stake thing, you'll never look at that stake.
No,
you'll be looking at that bear. Because
that
bear is going to come in and you're going to be focused and freaked out.
Yeah.
Because it's a bear. Yeah. It's not a whitetail. It's not a coyote.
In the wild.
Right. It's in the wild. You'll never look at that.
True.
And as an experienced hunter, it's a great idea.
Right.
Because I've hunted bears quite a few times. And even when that bear came in, I mean, I got excited. But it's not like my first time out there and seeing a bear, because we own 40 acres up north and in the lower, And we get bears. I see bears all the time. I was youth hunting with my boy a couple of years ago. We had a mom and two cubs come in, and then I had a great big bear. We actually, we're in the Baldwin zone. Takes many, many years to get a tag, too many. I have a bear on our property that will go 550. I guarantee it. Because I've got plenty of pictures, and you've seen them.
Yeah.
And he's huge.
Yeah.
And it's a boar.
Is that the one you had the thermal on?
I have thermal and I have trail cam pictures of it.
Yeah.
But he's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I guarantee he goes 550, but I applied for 10 years, never drew a tag. And that's when we started going with Randy.
Yeah. Another thing you could do too, and I think Randy talked about this before up there, either one of the other guys did. When a lot of guys, when they do their baits, you have the bait on there, you have landmarks around it, you have trees and shrubs. So you can kind of like walk up to it and say, okay, knee high is, you know, let's say this limb. Hip high is this limb. But also a lot of guys will spray down the surrounding trees with a mixture as a scent attractant. So a lot of times too, if you look at where that spray is, you'll see the wetness on the tree. And depending on where it is, you can use that as a gauge too, based on, you know, the bears here. And I know that wet mark is this high, or, you know, count the limbs on a tree or this height of your ferns, or
you could even go as far as, you know, bringing a stake that's marked out for a barrel and just marking it. If there's a tree close to your bait, just mark the tree.
Yeah.
That way, the problem with using the stake method, unless you're there like Randy has been there a month or going to be there a month or whatever, you're adding another piece of scent to that bait site. Where if you use, you know, just a tree, and honestly, I'd just take a knife and mark it, you know, notch it out a little bit so you can see it from where you're sitting. And that way you're not adding any scent to it. Because bears can't see for a dang or anything. I mean, their eyesight is horrible, but their ear is awesome, and their nose is awesome.
Yep. So in terms of the field judging, other than using something as a comparative for size thing, like we talked about before, the one thing you want to look at is the size of the ears on the head. Are they on top of the head, or are they on the side of the head? Look for a big sway belly, and the length of the legs are probably the things.
And if you get a big matured bear, they'll have a crease right down the middle of their forehead.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a crease, that's a big, nice bear. That's a mature bear. That crease will show you everything. But ears are a big one.
Yeah.
Sway bellies.
So I'm looking for.
I'm going to tell you right now, you're probably not going to see any of that.
Probably not.
But you're going to shoot the first bear you see.
Right.
Probably. But
I'm looking for ears.
Yeah.
How they're positioned on the head.
Yep.
And
if their ears look big.
If ears look big or not. Their chest. Right.
More belly.
More belly.
Like a big pop belly.
Because their belly is so big at that point, their legs look real small.
Yeah.
They look like they're
short legs.
Right. They look like they're dragging right on the ground, their bellies.
So them are my two primary.
Yep.
No. Things it, I should be, but I won't be. I agree. Right. I mean, I'll be so excited. It'll be
that crease is your big tell in their forehead, because if you get you can plainly see it.
Yeah,
it's like a split right down the middle of their forehead, mm-hmm. and the hairs part. It's like they're parted,
mm-hmm.
and that's a mature bear. But I've seen them in Canada, but I have not seen one in Michigan, because most bears up there are 150, 200, they can get up 250, they can get up 550. But when they get up that big, they're few and far between.
Yeah.
And usually the big bears are more nocturnal than the little bears. Because what happens is the big bears come in and they knock out that bait. Well, the little bears know they have to get there earlier than that big bear. So that's why we see more littler bears. Because they want to get that bait before the bigger bears.
Yeah.
And you'll know if a bear's on the bait, and it stands up and takes off like a streak of lightning, then
keep your eye peeled
because there's another bear coming.
Yeah, the big ones will come in and kick them off, especially a boar, right?
Yep. And you can tell a boar because it's funny, everybody thinks I'm crazy, but when a boar walks in, their tallywhacker hairs off the tip of it is probably 6-8 inches long. I mean, you can tell it
instantly.
Oh, yeah, instantly. You can see that.
I didn't know that.
Well, we haven't seen many boars up there.
I guess I never even thought about looking when the bear came in.
Right. And when if you're going to look for it, it's more on bigger bears. Littler bears, they don't have that.
Okay.
But bigger bears, you will see it for sure.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. So yeah, it's just, you know, again, especially being your first time up there, you're gonna get pretty pumped up. You're gonna be excited. All you can do is, you know, try and make control your breathing a little bit, and you know, make sure you're looking at a mature bear, you know, best you can. And the only thing you're not allowed to do up there is shoot sows with cubs.
Yep.
Other than that, I mean, they frown on shooting smaller bears at the DNR, like a cub.
Yeah, but, well, yeah. I mean, if it comes in by itself, you're not going to know. But most time, if a cub comes in, it's with a sow.
Right. And you should be able to tell a cub fairly easy. Yeah, now, one-year-old.
Yeah, I don't. Like I said, you're gonna, if it, unless it's got a sow with cubs, if it's by itself, you're killing it.
It'll
be hard to pass. And I've already discussed this with you guys. Like, I, my first year, if I have a chance to shoot something,
shoot it.
And I have a tag, which I do.
Yep.
And it's legal bear.
Yep.
I am.
As long as it doesn't have cubs,
it's going to
sow with cubs. I mean, even if it's a, even if it has cubs, you cannot shoot that sow.
Right.
Yep.
But I'm putting the crosshairs on it. I mean, it's, it'll be taken.
And, you know, vital wise, they're a little bit farther back, but aim for that front shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Since we were talking about, we discussed that, you know, which, where do I, where are vitals on a bear compared to a deer?
You aim center mass.
And you were talking about that with me before we started this before too. The size of their body is so small, gets just more fur.
Just like a wintertime coyote.
Right. Yeah.
There's so a lot of fur there.
So mm-hmm. It's center mass.
Center mass. But if you put your crosshair right on that front shoulder, it really ain't going there.
Yeah. Basically go straight up from the front leg.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to take out that front shoulder.
Yeah.
That way you're not, it's not gonna go far.
Yeah.
And you still get vitals, it's just the end of the vitals instead of center punching them.
Right. So another thing that interested me that what you guys talked about, you guys do, which just baffles me because I hunt whitetails and it's always about, I mean, so scent control is the same thing as playing the wind. Sorry, I'm gonna play in the wind just like I am a whitetail. What is crazy to me though is walking out to them bait sites and not being stealthy as possible and quiet. You guys were discussing that, which I not necessarily saying everybody does this, but it was just fascinating to me that getting them bears used to your noise, mm-hmm. baiting
and scent,
and getting your scent.
It's like bringing a dinner bell for them.
Yeah. Well, and that's why we go out and bait the sites so our scent is there.
Right.
And because, you know, even for whitetails, I'm not a huge scent control guy, and I've killed some nice whitetails.
Yep.
I play the wind. If you play the wind, 9 times out of 10, the scent don't matter. The only thing, if they come from behind you, they're going to know you're there.
Yep.
But if you know the bedding grounds, and even for whitetails, if you know the bedding grounds or where they're coming from at night, in the morning, whatever, if you can play that, you can kill them.
Yeah.
I don't wear scent lock. I mean, I take a shower with scent free soap and all that, but I don't wear scent lock. You know, when you're up there for the week, it's not like you're washing your clothes every other day.
Yep.
So, you know, you just got to play the wind. And same with whitetails. You don't need, if you wear scent lock, great. But the problem is, if you don't have an industrial dryer, a dryer gets hot enough, scent lock don't mean nothing. Or scent blocker, and whatever it is. It
doesn't have the heat to
activate it. Correct. So you're defeating the purpose anyway. You're spending a lot of money on a suit that really don't work. You just got to play the wind. And same thing with bears. Play the wind. And there's probably a lot of people out there that disagree with me, but that's how I hunt. I'm not asking anybody to hunt different than what, or as I hunt or different than I hunt. Yeah. It's just how I hunt. And I've killed a lot of nice whitetails.
But like back to what you were saying too about walking out to the bait. That's one thing that Scott taught me the first few times I hunted with him. She says, no, he would drive his truck out there. She had an old squeaky, I think it was a Ford Ranger, and you could hear that thing squeaking from a mile away before you could see it. And he'd grab a bucket, and he had a shovel, and he had a rake, and he'd grab all that stuff, and he'd get out. He'd carry it out, says, all right, let's go. And I'm thinking, you know, don't you want to whisper it? No, come on, let's go. Get out there. He'd, you know, move everything around, throw the bait in there, dump the rock on there. Then he'd rake it all out. He'd pound on the bucket to knock all the stuff into the bait. And I'm just sitting there thinking, don't you want to be quiet? He's like, no. So I want him to get used to that. I want him to associate that with, hey, now there's food here. And he told me later, he says, there's times where I've went out before and bears you can pattern fairly well. He says, I'd go out there and there'd be a bear waiting for me to put the bait out. He says, so, I mean, there's some stands I'll tell you, bring your gun with you when we go out and bait it because there might be a bear there waiting for us.
Yep.
you know, and I was like, that just baffled me. Well, but it's true. You're conditioning the animal sure to come is to that bait.
And the guy, when I hunted in Canada with my buddy Paul that owns Outfitter, when he baited, he banged the barrel.
Yep.
With a log or with the side of the bucket.
Something to make noise.
And the funny, and he runs cameras. You know what a lot of people do. And we'd leave that bait site, and within 2-3 minutes, that barrel's already there. Yep. They're just
sitting there waiting for you to leave.
It's a dinner bell.
Yep.
You know, and once they, the first couple of weeks, it's not, but as you get farther in the season, that's a dinner bell. They know what that means. Now there's bait. Now there's food there.
Hey, they got the good stuff over there. Let's go.
Yeah, they got Rice Krispie treats and greenhorns. I mean, you know, another thing, you can't bait with chocolate anymore.
Yeah.
So it's bait's harder to find now than what it ever
is. Yeah, because it used to be, I mean, shoot, I remember growing up with Scott. I mean, we had chocolate-covered cherries. We had donuts. He had, I mean, just all sorts of stuff. And now that you can't use chocolate, you have to be a lot more selective.
Well, a lot of people that sold bear bait in the past are not selling bear bait because they don't want to deal with not having the chocolate.
Right.
Because it's more of a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know, chocolate chunks or whatever, donuts. You can only have donuts without chocolate. Yeah. Well, if it's got chocolate chips in it, whatever it is, it's just chocolate.
And it's funny too, because, you know, there's such a variety of things you can actually use. I mean, pie filling, frosting, cherry pie filling, peanut butter, marshmallow,
granola, popcorn.
Popcorn. There used to be guys that used to get totes full of crushed cookies from like Keebler.
When we were in Canada, he had 55-gallon drums of cream horns.
Yep.
You know, and they love it.
Or right.
Lucky Charms marshmallows.
Yeah.
And back then he had chocolate, you know, and he'd have a whole tub of cherry pie filling.
Yeah.
Or apple pie filling. Or a whole tub of chocolate frosting, you know, or just frosting. Or he just had, and he'd stash barrels close to his bait site.
Yeah. And, you know, going back talking about those, the thing you find out, though, is bears do have a sweet tooth.
Uh-huh.
No doubt about it. Because last time we were up there, we bought a bunch of bagels, and they did not like those bagels worth a darn.
It's funny, too, because I've used, my uncle owns Brooklyn Bagels, and I can get all the day-old bagels I want, or, you know, and I use bagels. I give bagels to buddies that have gotten tags in Baldwin's own or wherever. And they send me pictures, bears walking around with bagels in their mouths.
Really?
And they loved them. They'd eat them all. But up there in the UP,
they didn't care for them.
No, they're bagel snobs. They don't like bagels.
And I think the second year I went up to Barriga, there was a farm down actually by Door, Michigan, that had the stuff they were advertising as like granola. And it was coated with a bunch of sweet stuff. I think it was cherry pie filling, whatever. But it was light granola. So I think I spent $350 on this tote. Drove it all the way up there before season. Dropped it off to them. They took one look at it and said, yeah, this stuff ain't going to work. I said, what do you mean it ain't going to work? They said, that's not, all that is leftover corn, like husks from when they shell and do the corn. It looks like granola, but it's not. And I was like, well, I was pretty disappointed, but I said, let's try it anyway. And, you know, we'd put all the other stuff they had in there in the bottom of the bait and put that stuff on top. Bears would dig that stuff out and get the
same
other
with
stuff
the bagels last year.
Right. Same thing.
I mean, it'd rain and there'd be bagels laying all around the baits, you know, all we'd kick them back in.
Wet and nasty. Right. And everything else.
They wouldn't eat them, but there was some muffins in there and they'd eat the muffins.
Oh, yeah.
They did not like them bagels. No. And, you know, the thing is, there's the bagels that he has, there's fruit bagels, there's all kinds of different bagels.
Yeah.
And they didn't like it. No. And when we left, we ended up dumping out quite a few barrels of bait because we didn't want to bring it back of bagels.
Right.
And Randy went up there a couple weeks later, was still there. They didn't even eat it.
The squirrels were eating it much. No. Yep. And then
I love his bagels.
Right. I mean, there's a variety of stuff. I've heard a lot of guys like to use beaver as a bait. Now, the downside from what I understand. Skin beavers.
Yeah.
Okay. The downside to using fish, meat, anything like that is, especially up there right now, is you're going to draw in wolves.
Mm-hmm.
You have anything meat on there, you're going to get other predators in there.
When I was in Canada, we used beaver carcasses all the time.
Really?
But he'd hang them up high.
For more of a scent thing?
Yeah. And the bears would end up getting them. Mm-hmm. But it would keep, the wolves would, they'd come in.
Makes sense.
You wolves know, couldn't get them on camera and they'd come in once and realize they couldn't get it and they'd leave and never come back.
Okay.
For days. But them bears would end up getting it, and it'd be gone within a couple of days. And you could hang it in the middle of the, I don't know how they even got it, because you'd throw a rope up over a limb that was hanging in the middle of this little field, and they'd get it. And it was gone. He'd hang them up by it with a coat hanger, you know, and they were not, they're ripe, but some of the anise oil or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
They love it.
Now, if we could get a beaver, we could always stick it to you know who and really get him going
like,
good up
like
there.
Kind of getting the dog to play with him, pork chop, right? Get the bears to play with him,
and wolves. I know, I think it was last year Randy was telling us one of the other guys that was hunting in his camp before we got up there had first season or second season, whatever. They were in a pop-up blind, and he actually had a bear come up and like try and stick his nose under the pop-up blind, freak the guy out. He wouldn't hunt in that pop-up blind anymore.
Well, a lot of people, the mistake they have is I've done it up at our property.
Eating in the blind?
Yep. Me and my son went out youth season, had a pop-up blind. We both ate sandwiches and stuff, and the crumbs or whatever we dropped on the ground, we go up there the next weekend, the blind is just destroyed.
Oh, yeah.
Because they wanted in there to get them that smell. Yeah. And they destroyed, the whole blind was destroyed. I mean, it wasn't even usable ever again.
Yeah.
But their noses are unbelievable awesome.
Oh, yeah. I know when we were out in Wyoming, we went by this tourist trap area. It was an old mining town. And they actually put up these huge, tall frames for you to hang food and garbage from.
Yeah.
And they have signs up there. It's illegal for you to have any food, anything like that, stored within, I don't know, it's like 200 yards of your camp.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they put up these frames, is for you to hang your stuff up there. Garbage. So it's kept away from your camp just for that reason, because of bears.
Well, and they tell you, they keep your coolers in your cars
and
locked and stuff like that. And then you hang your garbage up on them teepee type things just to keep the bears out of it.
I'd be concerned even leaving it in your car. I've seen plenty of videos of bears trying to get into people's cars. Well, scratch your ride all up.
I've got friends that were up in the Smoky Mountains last year, and they've got video of a bear opening the door with his mouth, getting in the car.
She had it figured out, huh?
Scratched all their leather all up and chewed a little hole in the headrest. I mean, it happens.
Right.
But they left the car unlocked. Yeah. You know, you got to make sure your car's locked. And most cars are scent proof, really. I mean, they're all sealed, but
right.
So yeah. I'll be using a 6.5 Grendel,
okay,
with 123 grain Hornady Black.
Mm-hmm.
What are you running?
I'm gonna be using my 260 Remington, same one I used last time, with 130 grain Sierra Game Changer bullet.
So I'm using my brand new AR-10 6.5 Creedmoor. The Hornaday bullet, but
143 grain ELDX.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm using.
Yeah, and that's the same load you used last time, yes. Right?
Same caliber, same load, just out of a AR platform. Rather, the first time was a bolt action.
Yeah,
I've been really impressed with my Grendel on whitetail. I'm very impressed. It's taken 4 deer that Grendel has taken. Very, very impressed. A lot of his shot placement, obviously, but it really performed really well.
That round, you know, I talk about that round a lot. It's my favorite, but I mean, I've seen guys take elk with it. I've seen guys Randy Booty took a bear with his the first year we were up there, and he was using a slightly lighter bullet than what you're going to be using, but he has a video on it from his ATN at that time, and that bear never took a step. Just dumped it right where it was. So I mean,
it has to do with shot
placement. It does. Yep. Shot placement. I mean, it helps to have a good bullet too, but shot placement is really important on it. But yeah, I have no doubt that will perform well for you.
Well, same with the Creedmoor. I haven't had an animal go more than 20 yards out of all the animals I shot with it.
And yeah.
I've never had one go more than 20 yards.
Yeah.
My Grendel, I shot deer with my Grendel, and again, one thing I will say, shooting suppressed is a huge difference. Okay. So I shot a doe year before last with my Grendel, all on video, suppressed. She was with 5 other does, shot the biggest doe. She ran off 25 yards, 30 yards, and died. Well, the other 4 deer, they just stayed right with her and ate with her and everything, because they don't know where that shot comes from. And when I shot my bear, same thing. It's just, it's so much nicer. You hear that impact. It doesn't freak out other animals. Same, this weekend is our Michigan youth season. My son's going to use my Creedmoor. And if he shoots one, it'll be suppressed. And my brother-in-law was worried about spooking all the deer out of there because it's not gun season, mm-hmm. but it is. And with suppressed, I'm not worried about
nope.
it. You know, and that's one thing I love about suppressed guns is you don't have to worry about that yep. as much.
I agree completely.
You know, I don't like youth season being able to use a gun, but if you can, you might as well join everybody else, I guess.
right.
But Lauren, if you use suppressed, it's not as big of a deal.
Yeah. I'm 50-50 on that. On this, I think we've discussed this before sitting in the shop.
Sure.
I can show video after video after I shoot a coyote in the field, and within 2 minutes, another one at a full sprint to us.
Well, the thing is, though, like
the money aspect of it is for
me. But I would probably disagree with that because that double eye shot, for instance, they were both together. I shot the first one, dropped him. The other one ran maybe 15 yards, stops, looks back, looking for his mate. Without a suppressed gun, I don't think that animal would have stayed that close because they were only 40 yards away.
I think me, if I get into, so I bought, I'm building my own suppressor. For me, it'd be more of hunting with my partner, you mm-hmm. guys, you know.
Oh, that's the main reason.
And my children's ears
yeah,
would be a big thing.
Well, that's the main reason why you buy a suppressor, but it does help. You know, whether you believe it or not, I believe it helps.
I don't think it doesn't.
Because that doe I shot 2 years ago, that doe was only 10 yards. Because I had to wait for it to come through the thick stuff. So I had 5 does within 10 to 15 yards, almost under me. I shot that. They ran another 20 yards and just kept feeding. Every other gun I've shot before I got suppressed, them deer were gone.
Yeah.
Like I could have shot another doe. Mm-hmm. If I had another doe tag. No problem. But in the years past, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So I believe it helps, but you're right. The main reason why I got it is for Kevin's ears, your ears, my kids' ears.
Yeah.
And when you're hunting coyotes and you're lined up and one or two coyotes come in and the middle guy starts blasting, the two guys on the end, if they don't have a suppressor, your ears are ringing because you're not that far apart.
Here's an example, a good point of that. Can you imagine how we'd all be right now if none of us were shooting suppressor in Louisiana?
Yeah,
our ears would probably still be ringing.
We'd be deaf
because you know the mags were what 30 rounders, and yeah. I emptied mine.
Yeah, I emptied mine.
Yeah, so there's 60, and
yeah, you got 4 shooters lined up, all right. within pretty much touching distance, right. and you're unloading on 30 pigs,
right.
pretty much until you can't shoot anymore. If those were unsuppressed,
well, that's why they make you
right.
If you don't have a suppressor,
they'll hook you up.
They hook you up with yeah. one. And that's why they do it.
And it's that reason, and too, because they do hunt around farmland. They don't want to be waking everybody up with right. it too. You know, I mean, shoot, you imagine if you're all of a sudden you heard 100 rounds go off behind your house, full volume in the middle of the night, wake you up too. And yep. you wouldn't be happy about
yep.
it.
Yep. No, so. I love my suppressed gun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, I really, to be honest with you, I really don't ever want to shoot a gun without one.
I don't either.
And you know, I'm doing that 350 Legend, and I'm gonna tell you right now, it will be suppressed for, and it'll have a 350 Legend suppressor on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not because of hunting, it's because of hearing.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference.
Sure.
And you, when you're out there and you got a suppressed gun and you shoot and you hear it hit that coyote or deer, whatever it is, you can actually hear it hit that animal.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you got a loud gun without a suppressor, you don't hear
that. Yeah, you're hearing an echo of a
shot. I never heard that before in my life until Kevin, you know, I hunted with Kevin and he had a suppressor. I'm like, what was that? That was my bullet hitting the coyote.
Wasn't that with you, me, and Rick? Because you guys were on one side of this tree line, I was on the other.
I expected
the coyotes yep. to come over there, and it didn't. It came yep. out on my
yep.
side.
Yep. And you could hear it. Yeah, you know, it's not like you see on the movies. It's not
Hollywood quiet.
Right. No. Mm-hmm. So you still hear a bang, but then after that little bang, you hear that thwack, like it's a bow shot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just, it's so thrilling and soothing, really. I mean, mm-hmm. knowing that, yep. Because you know that sound. Yeah, everybody knows that sound. And you just know that, man, I got that in. And you know for sure. You know, whether it's a deer or a bear.
Right. And I've noticed too, there's several other guys that are kind of big in the predator industry that have recently went suppressed. Heath Baker, for example, and James Bostock. Both of those guys recently went into the suppressor realm. And I know both of them have said, man, I don't know if I would have had that same action without having the suppressed gun. Now, James Bostock, he went with a Form 1, similar to what you're doing, built his own. Heath Baker, I think, actually bought a production one and put it on his gun. But again, you know, thinking back to it, my dad was always in the construction industry, always around loud noises. Back then, you know, when he was up until really suppressors have gotten really big since they passed the law in Michigan, allowing us to use them and allowing them for hunting. Up until that point, no one used them. And my dad's hearing is shot. I mean, he has to wear hearing aids. And I just, you know, after a while, when you start thinking about the suppressor thing, you think about the shooting you do, especially if you do trap and skeet, if you go to the range a lot, if you do a lot of volume shooting, like doing hogs, or if you're on coyotes a lot or whatever, every time you shoot, you're degrading your hearing. Mm-hmm. And anything I can do to prevent that, I'm going to do it. And if it means, you know, having to wait for 11 months to get a suppressor to clear the paperwork from the ATF,
how long it took me?
I did it twice. You know, nice thing is when you get ready to do yours of that Form 1, you'll probably have it in less than a month. I think the approval time on them is still pretty darn quick.
It's still low.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's...
And once you have it, you'll never want to shoot another gun.
Yeah.
It's totally different talking about it until you have it.
And you feel biased sometimes because, I mean, I know we went out one time. I think I went down with Josh and Tony Bonin and Zegden. Tony Bonin and Zegna had gotten this new linear comp, which Josh uses one. I know several other guys that use them too. And he's like, yeah, I got this new Archon, you know, linear comp on there. And he shot a coyote with it. He said, man, doesn't that sound better? And I'm used to my suppressor. I'm like, sure. Yeah, it sounds better.
It sounds loud.
Yeah, it's still loud. But I mean, yeah, you know, linear comp does help. But like you said, once you go to it,
it's hard to get away from.
It is. I mean, you'll want to use it on every gun. And then, most cases, it's not hard to put it on a different gun.
Well, I have the quick detach.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's the only way that I'll...
Right.
Unless you do like this 350 I'm going to do, I'm going to screw it on the barrel. It's never going to come.
Right. Direct thread.
But if you want to use it on multiple different guns...
Oh, yeah.
The quick detach is so easy. Yep. Or it's hard to find a case that long, too, right. When you go to a 20-inch barrel and you got a 12-inch... suppressor on it, it's hard to find a case that long. Right. So that quick detach does help.
Take it on and off, it's in the case, no problem.
Right.
You know,
so it does help. There's different, you know, a lot of people go thread on, some people go quick detach. I just preferred the quick detach on this one.
And that worked great. I mean, that system you got, I'd never heard of that system you had until you showed it to me at DNR Sports. And that seems like a really nice system. I know it works great on your guns and on and off easy.
Yep. So, I've shot a lot of rounds through it.
Mm-hmm. From multiple rifles, too, which is nice. Yeah. You have it set up for, what, on four guns now? Five?
Mm-hmm.
Your pistol, your bolt-action Creedmoor, your AR-10 Creedmoor,
yep.
Your .223
yep.
rifle.
Yep, and my Crandall.
Yeah, so five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And each quick detach is $100.
Right. Yeah.
So... there's 500 right there.
So keep that in mind, actually, as you build your Form 1, you can get a QD mount set up on that Form 1.
Because you have two Grendels. You could run it on
each Grendel.
Yep. Yeah. All you have to do is get the adapter and thread the base piece for that adapter. So you could do that with a Form 1, I believe.
And I'm telling you, if you can, that's so convenient.
Yeah, I'll get into that.
Yep. Anything else you want to add before we go bear hunting?
Nope, just excited to get up there.
15 days, guys.
15 days.
I'm ready.
Great.
You know, and honestly, I hope we all get a bear. But you know what? We're going to be up in the wild, in the wilderness, mm-hmm. enjoying nature.
Way in the wilderness.
And there's not much there. And
That's what I like. Good company with, you know, Joe and Randy and us three, and it'll be a good time either way, but I hope we all get our bears,
you know.
And it'd be nice if once one guy gets a bear, then he can hunt with another guy and film or whatever. And
yeah,
we're just gonna have a good time. I'll tell you right now, we'll eat good.
We'll eat good. we ain't gonna starve.
No, no, we'll be doing good.
I'm gonna do a couple pork butts up, and we'll do some pulled pork and smoke some meats before I go, and we'll have a good time.
Yep,
I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. All right, guys, thank you for coming, and we will talk to everybody later.
Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Predator Hunter Outdoors. Whether you are new to predator hunting or looking to upgrade your equipment, Predator Hunter Outdoors will have you hunting after the sun goes down. Carrying a full line of lights, night vision, and thermal optics, along with tripods, calls, mounting systems, and more, check them out at www.predatorhunteroutdoors.com or on Facebook at Predator Hunter Outdoors. Use promo code OVERDRIVE2021 for 20% off your order.